Hello and welcome on board this express service from Midori House. I'm your driver, Andrew Tuck. This week, our show is entirely devoted to London's most important mode of transport, the bus. From the omnibus to the arrival of the double-decker, we take a look at how the humble bus has helped define the city around it and the stories that it left along the way. So, do you have a ticket? That's all coming up right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. So, welcome to this week's programme. Find a seat, please, and get comfortable. Our journey will last about 30 minutes. And joining me are fellow passengers Travis Elborough and Joe Kerr. Travis is an author and Joe is an architectural historian and also a bus driver. They've just released a new book called Bus Fare, which tells the history of the London bus through a collection of different writings about it through the years. And throughout our interview, you'll be able to hear some of these historical articles too. We start our conversation talking about the Omnibus, a horse-drawn service connecting Paddington to Bank, helmed by a uniform-wearing driver and conductor. Let's try to imagine it.
Welcome aboard. Move down the bus, please. Everybody find a seat. And before we begin our journey, a reminder of the rules. Rule number one, keep your feet off the seats. Rule number two, do not get into a snug corner yourself and then open the windows to admit a nor'wester upon the neck of your neighbour. Rule number three, have your money ready when you desire to alight. If your time is not valuable, that of others may be. Rule number four, do not impose on the conductor the necessity of finding you change. He is not a banker. Rule number five, sit with your limbs straight and do not let your legs describe an angle of 45 degrees, thereby occupying the room of two persons. Rule number six, do not spit upon the straw. You are not in a hog's die, but in an omnibus travelling in a country which boasts of its refinement. Rule number seven, behave respectfully to females and put not an unprotected lass to the blush because she cannot escape from your brutality. Rule number eight, if you bring a dog, let him be small and confined by a string. Rule number nine, do not introduce large parcels. An omnibus is not a van. Rule number 10, reserve bickerings and disputes for the open field. The sound of your own voice may be music to your own ears, not so, perhaps, to those of your companions. Rule number 11, if you will broach politics or religion, speak with moderation. All have an equal right to their opinions, and all have an equal right not to have them wantonly shocked. Rule number 12, refrain from affection and conceited airs. Remember, you are riding a distance for sixpence, which, if made in a hackney coach, would cost you as many shillings, and that should your pride elevate you above plebeian accommodations, your purse should enable you to command aristocratic indulgences. The Times, 30th of January, 1836.
Joe, let's start with you. So the fascinating thing is, I guess when people think they're going to read a book about buses, they've already got a picture in their mind of something red and gleaming and with four wheels on. But you start with actually something with wheels and hoofs as well at the beginning of the book. You look at the kind of roots of the London bus system going all the way back to the omnibus. Could you just explain to the listeners a little bit about those early days and the people who drove those horse-drawn omnibuses that we have in a way to thank for what we have today?
It was very important for us that we did the whole history of the bus. It's nearly 200 years now. And I don't think people necessarily realise that, you know. We say in the book that people start to think about buses with Cliff Richard and Routemasters and swinging 60s, you know. But there's this whole other history. And because it's not so visual, the Victorian stuff, the writing is the kind of important way into it. And when you read it, you realise that although it's changed massively, you know, those were horse buses and things that were different. Nonetheless, there's so much commonality, you know. We would recognise the behaviour that's described on buses in that period. We would recognise the people who work on buses in that period. And it's fantastic. I love that continuity of London history.
Mr. Shillabeer is the guy who starts off. And what is it that he does that makes it a bus rather than, you know, just jumping on a coach or hitching a ride with someone? What are the things we identify with the moment of buses beginning?
It was an innovation that he brought from Paris. He'd actually worked in Paris. And again, Londoners don't tend to realise that the London bus is actually a French invention. But the idea that you'd have a short-haul vehicle which seated a lot of people and would stop very, very frequently and didn't cost too much money, was something absolutely new. Coaches had done longer distances, they were more expensive, they were exclusive, whereas the London bus from the beginning was quite a democratic vehicle. You know, anyone could use it for a relatively modest fee.
And Travis, what did that mean for a city? You know, we talked today about mobility, and we're all concerned about how these changes in the way that we get around will affect the way the city looks, the way it functions. We're talking there with Joe about democratising of access to mobility. When the omnibus came along, what did it do for London?
I mean, one of the things about it is that it has to run on slightly outside the main drag of the city, because the Hackney carriages had a kind of monopoly on the inner central London area. So Shillibeer's bus runs along what was then called the New Road. It departed from outside the Yorkshire Stingo pub in Paddington along what is now Marylebone Road and Euston Road and Pentonville Road to the City of London. And so it kind of immediately instantiates the idea of the suburban commuter. Suddenly, people can work in the City of London and get a bus into their place of work rather than living closer to it. So it just kind of transforms how people negotiate the city and think about the city. It creates the omnibus, horsepower omnibus, coupled eventually with railways and later tube lines, creates the idea of a kind of suburban London where, you know, Pooters, the classic Pooter, the commuter, you know, based in George Grossmith's great comic creation, who lives in the laurels in Holloway. And the joke of that is, in a way, that, you know, he thinks he's living in this country idyll when in fact it's just off the Holloway Road, you know. And it's a kind of mocking, Grossmith is kind of mocking the sort of petty bourgeois aspirations of this man. But it just means that people can finally get around London and live further away from the smog of industry. It really, in a way, almost creates the suburbs. It's the first step on the road to the suburbs. I mean, Shillibeer himself, he profits reasonably well to begin with, but very quickly other operators, cannier operators, come onto the scene. At this point, there's no monopoly on who can run buses. So there's this kind of frenzy of new horse buses, you know, pulling up and down streets in London, and that Shillibeer himself eventually goes out of business. But it, for a time, it's like the sort of Wild West, in a way, of horse-drawn omnibuses in the city, where, you know, the conductors, in a sense, were known as sort of cads, because they sort of stuff as many people as they possibly could into their carriages in order to make as much money as possible.
And Joe, this huge new market, was it just an untapped market, or is this a moment of change for the city, that more and more people are coming into the city, and so there is this pressure for mobility? Because the strange thing is, you wonder how people got around before. Were people just literally walking everywhere and working much closer to their homes, for example?
Yes and yes to those questions. So I think that the city had actually virtually clogged up. You know, London had ground to a halt. So the bus was one of the things that helped it start to move again. And otherwise, you walked or you used the river, or if you're very rich, you used the cab. But it was chaos out there. And the great thing about the bus, the thing we learned, is that everybody gets on the bus, you know. So it's classless. And women start to use it and start to explore the city and get access to bits of the city that they had not had before. And everyone acquires that knowledge, that essential knowledge that Londoners have, which is where buses go, you know. It's one of the things that makes you a Londoner, is knowing, oh, I can get the bus from there and then I change there and I take the next one. And all these people develop this knowledge in Victorian times.
I mean, Shillibeer unveils his horse bus in 1829. 7 years later is when London Bridge Station opens up, so steam trains bringing commuters from further out. So it's exactly that kind of moment where London is moving from being a kind of a more agrarian city into a heavily industrialised one. So it's an absolute sort of pivotal moment as far as the city growing and transforming. By 1850, more people are living in towns and cities in Britain than are living in the countryside. So it's, again, one of those sort of, it's the right vehicle for the right moment.
No, I must say for listeners, one of the great things about the book is it's not just literary pieces. This is like, you understand the mores of the time, because you've got like how to behave in a bus, you've got what makes a good and bad conductor. And I found those bits kind of really insightful and glorious to read. The motor comes along, the bus becomes a little bit closer to what we think about. All through all this, the bus survives and adapts. And as you say, we begin to get better train lines into London, we begin to get the underground, we begin to get more motor vehicles. Joe, why did the bus not only survive on the streets, but stay key in people's mind when they thought about the city? And just one other tiny thing, I think it says on the press releases, you know, that tourists in London travel by tube, Londoners travel by bus. And you really hammer this point home that it's always been part of the psyche of a Londoner to know their bus route, for example.
Yeah, and buses carry something like 3 times more passengers than tubes. You know, we imagine that tubes are the great workhorse of London. No, it's the 9,000 buses that were out there this morning at 8 o'clock and will be out there this evening at 5 o'clock. You know, they're the things that carry people. And when the motor bus arrives, it's really quite pioneering. I mean, there are motorised vehicles, but it happened so quickly. You know, they introduced the first motor bus in the very early years of the last century, and within 10 years, all the buses are motor buses, you know, thousands of them. And they introduced kind of advanced designs for them. The famous B-type bus was one of the first mass-produced vehicles ever made in this country, you know. So it's at the kind of forefront of technological innovation, as well as enabling this enormous, rapidly expanding city to grow.
But why did it see off, for example, you know, the tram or the trolley bus, which we did have here in London? Yeah. It saw them off.
Well, they grew at the same time. I mean, so trams and trolley bus, well, the trams arrive in the late 19th century and last till the 1950s. Trolley buses last from the 30s to the 60s. But buses are flexible. Buses can go almost anywhere. You know, as long as there's not a low railway bridge or an overhanging tree or a narrowness. Otherwise, buses can go down most streets of London. And if something happens, like a bomb drops in the Blitz or a water main bursts, you can just divert a bus. You can't do that with a tram, you can't do that with a trolley bus, and you certainly can't do that with an underground train.
There's an interesting class element to this as well, actually, that buses were considered more middle class as a means of transport, although obviously they're democratic as well, because they could move into more suburban and more salubrious districts that trams and other vehicles wouldn't necessarily visit.
And the good people of Hampstead said they didn't want trams because trams would bring the great unwashed. So there's always been buses in Hampstead. There were never trams.
Armistice observed. Although there was no ceremony in Whitehall today, all the buses stopped at 11 o'clock and people stood still in the streets. Journal entry, James Agate, 11th of November, 1939.
War-torn London, relit. Bus lighting restored. How strange it seems to see the buses well lit, upstairs and down. Headlights on, as required. The streets will look like fairyland when the lamps go on again at full power. Diaries. F.T. Lockwood, 27th of April, 1945.
Joe, how did the bus, you know, manage to navigate two world wars when there's a shortage of fuel, when, as you say, many roads are being bombed, that communities are being challenged, especially in the Second World War? How do they manage to keep the London buses running throughout that war?
It was an extraordinary, prodigious effort, to be honest, you know, and they almost did run out of fuel, and the government was minded to take them off the roads, and they were reduced in number in both wars. But the really interesting story, of course, is that they were forced to employ women to make them work. So in late 1915, the first woman trains as a conductor. And by the end of the war, all the conductors are women, and lots of the maintenance staff and the engineering staff are women as well. Sadly, in 1919, they got rid of them all again. But in the Second World War, they had to bring women back, and they wanted to get rid of them again in 1945. But by then, there weren't enough people. People didn't want those jobs, and they were forced to concede that actually women had a role to play. And so they've remained working on the buses ever since.
It's also to do with race as well, because the bus companies go to Barbados and they start recruiting there to bring people, the Windrush generation, into the buses. So maybe you could just touch on that as a tool for social change.
The earliest black British bus driver that we know is a man called Joe Clough, who was actually employed in 1910. So the story goes back even earlier. But you're right. After the Second World War, London Transport has a shortage of labour. It looks to Malta, and actually looked to sort of Polish exiles that were based in London at that time. And eventually it then starts to look to the Caribbean, to Barbados, and later to Jamaica. So the two-person bus, which needs this extra level of staffing because you've got a driver and a conductor, plays a kind of important part in the multicultural story of London, and, you know, bringing people from former colonies into the sort of lifeblood of London as citizens, residents, and, you know, and employees. So it's a very, very important story in that.
And working alongside more traditional white crews and so forth. So it kind of integration from the word go. And that's very important. And there are extraordinary stories. I've met men who arrived on a plane on a Friday and were at Chiswick Training Ground on the Monday, you know, literally straight from Barbados to Chiswick, and a week later on a bus.
Joe, we've mentioned in the introduction to this piece that you are an academic who still works a couple of days a week as a bus driver. And when we think about that cultural landscape and the sense of community that seems to have been ever present in the history of the bus companies, is that still surviving today? We know there are challenges for transport in London. We know that many of the crews feel a little bit more threatened sometimes by the kind of people who jump on the bus. But for you, does there still feel that sense of camaraderie and that the bus does something special?
There is a real spirit about it still. It's not quite the same as when they were crew buses with conductors. You know, garages aren't as lively because you used to work with somebody else. Driving is quite a solitary activity. But, you know, it's true, bus drivers do wave to each other. And it's, I don't know, it's a tiny little thing, but it really makes my day. At 6 o'clock in the morning, you know, on a miserable cold day, your mate comes past the other way and you salute each other, you know, and there is that camaraderie of the road. So that's really, really important. Again, it's not the same as it was in London Transport days, because London Transport was this great paternalistic organisation, you know, that ran your life pretty much, you know. You signed up everything to them, whereas now, of course, it's a more commercial activity. But it's still a very important part, that sense of the fellowship of the road.
Omnibuses, Street Sketches number 1, Charles Dickens. As we get into the city a little before 10, 4 or 5 of our party are regular passengers. We always take them up at the same places, and they generally occupy the same seats. They're always dressed in the same manner and invariably discuss the same topics. The increasing rapidity of cabs and the disregard of moral obligations evinced by omnibus men. There's a little testy old man with a powdered head who always sits on the right-hand side of the door as you enter, with his hands folded on the top of his umbrella. He's extremely impatient and sits there for the purpose of keeping a sharp eye on the cat, with whom he generally holds a running dialogue. He's very officious in helping people in and out, and always volunteers to give the cat a poke with his umbrella when anyone wants to alight. He usually recommends ladies to have sixpence ready to prevent delay, and if anybody puts a window down that he can reach, he immediately puts it up again.
Now, what are you stopping for?
Says the little man every morning, the moment there is the slightest indication of pulling up at the corner of Regent Street, when some such dialogue as the following takes place between him and the cat.
What are you stopping for?
Here the cat whistles and affects not to hear the question.
I say, what are you stopping for?
For passengers, sir.
I know you're stopping for passengers. You've no business to do so. Why are you stopping?
Why, sir? That's a difficult question. I think it's because we prefer stopping here to going on.
Now mind,
exclaims the little old man with great vehemence.
I'll pull you up tomorrow. I've often threatened to do it. Now I will.
Thank you, sir,
replies the cat, touching his hat with a mock expression of gratitude.
Very much obliged to you indeed, sir.
Here the young man in the omnibus laugh very heartily, and the old gentleman gets very red in the face and seems highly exasperated. The stout gentleman in the white neckcloth at the other end of the vehicle looks very prophetic and says that something must shortly be done with these fellows, or there's no saying where all this will end. And the shabby genteel man with the green bag expresses his entire concurrence in the opinion, as he has done regularly every morning for the last 6 months. Morning Chronicle, 26th of September, 1834.
Travis, tell me, when you began to collect all these pieces of writing, and as I said, it is rich and varied, and it's amazing how many different kinds of writing about buses that you've found. Were you surprised that it did hold such a central point? I know you come back to Virginia Woolf a couple of times in the introduction to the book to say that you see there a woman who was living in Bloomsbury, who understood what was going on in central London in all sorts of extraordinary ways. But one of the things she knew about was the bus timetable.
Yeah. I mean, for her, I think it's important. She sees the motorised bus as an emblem, in a way, of modernity, of the modern metropolis, which is growing at that point. Obviously, suburbanisation is happening there, so buses are reaching further and further out into the countryside. And she, to know about London's buses, is an important part of her street smarts, if I want to have a better word. Not that anyone's ever used the word street smarts to describe Virginia Woolf, I suspect. But it's part of her persona, in a way, that she takes on the idea of being a Londoner. It involves her knowing about the London buses and the routes that they move in, and being au fait with the rituals of them. And she puts that into her fictions. Going back to your question about the writing, and what surprised us in a way is when we go right back to the 19th century, is actually a similar process is going on. People like Dickens, it's incredibly important to Dickens that he knows what's happening with the horse buses. Similarly, you know, Mayhew, who does the great London Labour and Poor, the great sociological study, he interviews, you know, a bus driver, a timekeeper and a conductor. So it's important for them to get a handle, in a way, on this phenomenon. And that sense of people knowing about the buses just seems to percolate on through time, through each generation of writers. And as you say, the book contains a variety of approaches and responses to it. There are historical documents, newspaper reports and so on, and articles written at various points in time. But there are also, you know, stories, poems and, in a way, kind of found material. I mean, one of the last pieces in the book is a photographer, documentary maker, Julius Beltrami's night bus updates from his Facebook feed. So that idea of still commenting on the buses, whether it be, you know, Mayhew interviewing them or someone's just their own personal experience of it.
Joe, let's jump to recent years, an aesthetic, a design story. So many Londoners were very sad to see the disappearance of the traditional route master, where you could leap on the back and on a summer's day you could be holding onto the pole. They were seen as dangerous and not great for access for other people. Then we had the bendy bus, which never kind of got into people's imagination, even though it was potentially good for more people to get on and off. There was certainly, for fare dodgers, it was meant to be more easy to get on and off. And then we moved on to the, what you, I think, quite generously called the Boris bus in your book, designed by the industrial engineer, or the industrial designer rather, Thomas Heatherwick, which looks beautiful, and but divides opinion. People say it's too hot in the summer, etc., etc. You've driven them all, you've seen them all. What's your feeling about all those buses? Let's give
small one there.
Are you allowed to give them kind of like marks out of 10 in lovable terms and in useful terms?
I can tell you that driving route masters, they're lovely things to drive. They were quite a modern bus for their day. And, you know, they came out of Second World War military technology, because London Transport had built bombers during the war, and everything they knew about building Halifax bombers went into the design of the route master. But you look in that cab today, it's so primitive. You know, the first route master ran before Sputnik went up. The last route master was built before the Apollo rockets landed on the moon. You know, this is pre-space age technology. And in comparison, the Boris bus is a very sophisticated vehicle. It has lots of technical problems. It was rushed into production far too early because it was a political vanity project. They're very nice to drive. I like the fact that they've revived the idea of a bus as a designed environment. Because, you know, buses before that looked a bit like play school sets, all done in bright, hideous colours, you know, migraine-inducing, with horrible seats. There was no sense of it being an environment. And Heatherwick quite rightly said a bus should be like the old idea of going to a cinema. It should take you away from ordinary life, you know. It should make you feel a little bit special. And I think it does that, I have to say.
Yeah, I like the Heatherwick bus in many ways. The only thing about the old route masters, I'm old enough to remember jumping on the bus and deciding whether you want to sit in the smoking area or the non-smoking area. There's all those kind of social changes, Travis, that have happened around the bus as well. Yeah. We kind of forget, you know, that it was on a winter's day getting on downstairs and everyone like smoking away heavily and stubbing it out on the wooden floor.
the upper deck was the smoking lounge, yeah. I think you'll find. Yeah. But yeah, it was the... I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, one of the things about contemporary buses are that, you know, they're supposed to be coping, or kind of a bit larger, a bit bigger. They've got to cope with both disabled access, which is obviously a very kind of noble ambition, but also the kind of shopping and the shape of the human beings that are getting onto them. So those are very physical changes which have occurred. As Joe said, the route master emerges when London is, you know, in the era of post-war austerity, and there's probably not a lot of food around, so maybe people are a little slimmer and we're than rather contemporary shapes. But a contemporary bus has to respond to the needs of the contemporary city. I agree with both of you, though. I think the Heatherwick bus, as a vehicle, the design of it felt a lot calmer. The lighting spec, for example, and the nod to the traditional moquette design, and the wooden floors, actually, which is kept in the design. So entering it, it feels less tense, whereas often some contemporary buses, as Joe said, with their bright colours, rather gaudy fabrics and ill-shaped seats, felt the opposite of it. They don't feel very calm at all. They feel as though they're intensifying your experience of the city. And I think that's certainly something that, as far as a design for any kind of future buses for London, should take some lessons from, the idea of an environment which feels as though you have sort of gone up in the world by entering it, rather than you're being kind of humiliated and forced into a, you know, a sort of tin can in order to negotiate the city.
And the original name for it was the New Bus for London. So rather than just buying an off-the-shelf bus that could be in Glasgow or Leicester or Kuala Lumpur, it was genuinely designed for London. Not in the same sense the Routemaster was designed for London, built in London, you know, never left London. But I do like that London has its own vehicle again.
A bus retires. London's most famous bus, the 40-year-old Regent 3, made its final run last Saturday and received a big send-off. Watched by hundreds of people, a cavalcade of RTs left London Transport's Barking Garage to make their final run over the 62 route to Ilford and Barkingside. This is London Transport's last route to be worked by RTs, and 200 enthusiasts had booked to go on this last run. The cavalcade was led by RT1, now in private hands, the very first production model, followed by six London Transport RTs and several other privately owned examples. It returned to Barking Garage shortly after 6 p.m. to be given a cheering reception by the patiently waiting crowd. As one enthusiast put it, the end of an era. The RT, Regent 3, first entered service with London Transport in 1939, and with its narrow, upright radiator grille and half cab, became one of London's best-known sights and a tourist attraction in its own right. About 7,000 were built, and with a 40-year history, the RT was London's longest-serving bus. Commercial Motors, 13th of April, 1979.
Last couple of short questions. Joe, one for you first. You know, we see this debate in London that, you know, are the numbers of people using the London Underground buses potentially going down a little bit because of the success of ride-sharing apps, for example. We know that there's meant to be a boom in one day in driverless vehicles, we'll see. We know many people are feeling so frustrated with the clogged-up city that they're turning to bicycles and pedestrianised ways of getting to work. If you did this book again in 20 years' time, do you think there'd be as much rich writing about the bus to be added?
Write off the London bus at your peril. I mean, they are being...
I wasn't doing it, I was just raising the idea.
Indeed. I mean, you know, they are threatened at the moment, but only in central London, really, because traffic speeds in central London are down to where they were when horse traffic was on the roads. So people get off them in central London, but they're thriving out in the suburbs, and one of the changes that's happening is that buses are being moved away from the middle to the edges. I think the London bus is here to stay. I think it would be more flexible. Already, technology allows us to know when a bus is coming, for instance, which in the past it was just, you know, you stood there and prayed, didn't you? You know, so there'll be a lot more flexibility, and it will become more user-centric, as all devices in our life have become. But it'll be there in 20 years.
Now, I'm sure you're going to know the answer to this question. You're in trouble if you don't. So could you both pick a number, not out of a hat, but a number of a bus route? We're talking to people around the world. If they're coming to London and they're going to jump on a London bus, Joe, what number would you...
It's so easy for me. It's the one I drive. It's the number 19 bus that does all the tourist sites. It goes right through the heart of the West End. It's a fantastic route, a beautiful London institution. And very importantly, it's been running on that route since 1906, we think.
Wow. And Travis?
As a resident of Stoke Newington, I feel almost beholden to say the 73, which is, again, a rather classic old route that moves from the east of the city or northeast of the city and down into the centre and into the West End, you know, passing along the Euston Road. So, you know, picking up bits of Shillibeer's original old route. It used to go all the way to Victoria. It has been shortened now and only goes as far as Oxford Circus. But it's still, I think, a majestic number of a bus route.
Well, there you have it. Travis and Joe, thank you so much. And that's all for this week's episode of The Urbanist. The show was produced by Carlotta Rabello, and your tickets were collected by David Stevens. Now, to play you out this episode of The Urbanist, well, it's a nod to the French original, the inspiration for London's very first omnibus. It's Brigitte Bardot with Omnibus. Thank you for listening, city lovers.
Des hommes express, il y a les femmes, des hommes pullman, celles qui aiment la compagnie, des wagons-lits. Quant à moi, ce que j'aime le plus, c'est de loin tous les hommes.